You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Yeah, you make my life better.
Everything I need in the morning.
It's my favorite show ever.
They keep it fun in the morning.
I love you guys. I love you guys.
Welcome to The Lisa Show. I'm Lisa Valentine Clark.
And I am Richie T.
Have you ever started your own business? Are you thinking about it? Well, coming up in 20 minutes, we're going to tell you what you need to do before you even begin.
Bad news for the movie house industry. Uh-oh. The writing, they say, is on the wall with one famous theater claiming for bankruptcy. I'll tell you about what theater that is and what that may mean for the future of movie houses. That's coming up in your Morning Buzz.
Writing is a skill we all have to learn, but many still dread. Staring at a blank sheet of paper can be daunting. How do you write that very first sentence?
Once upon a time.
I know, right? Now listen, especially when you're going to rewrite it, right? You know you're going to go back. Many of us want to become better writers for a variety of reasons, whether it's for creative writing, whether it's for work, but we're just afraid. And that struggle is real. But does it have to be as difficult as we're making it out to be? Well, today we're talking with Marnie Neer, Chief Content Officer and Life Coach at Handle Group. She's published a lot of many creative projects, including co-creating the TV show Mother Up and co-writing the book Maybe It's You. Welcome, Marnie.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I want to get right to the problem I think that a lot of people dread when they first begin, which is writer's block. Tell me what you really think that means and why it happens.
At Handle Group, we teach a lot about inner dialogue and what you say to yourself. And we've even, named some of the voices in your head to kind of try to get a sense of humor about it. Because most of us really think that voice in our head is, us, the real me. And thank God it's not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is an important distinction to make. It's not really you.
It's not intuition. It's not gut. It's not any of that. What we call it is it's either your inner chicken or your brat or a weather reporter. We have a couple other names, but those are the three main ones.
A weather reporter. I've never heard that.
it's the voice in your head. It's like your, I know Al Roker, right? It's the voice in your head that speaks about you like you have nothing to do with it. Right? Just like it rains in Seattle, Barney is not a morning person.
You know what I mean? Huh.
And that just allows me to be icky till noon. I just wrote myself that sort of doctor's note or hall pass.
So when we talk about voices in our head, I think everyone has that own sort of personal narrative that keeps them from trying to do those things. And I love that you've gone with some levity to be like, oh, is it this voice or this voice or this voice or this voice?
It's a good approach.
But if we're going to put pen to paper and make some progress, we have to at least turn down the volume on those voices. How do you recommend we do that?
Well, part of it, right, is... So it's first distinguishing it, right? So you're like, oh, this is what my voice of fear sounds like, right? And you're like, fear is never going away, okay? The bigger you play, the louder it gets, because your head's job is to keep you safe and not doing anything stupid, like saying you're going to write a TV show, right? It just is out to go protect you from failing or possibly failing. Mm. So it preemptive strikes, right? It already anticipates your suckage.
Oh, yeah.
But it doesn't help, right? It doesn't help in the creativity, in the flow of writing. So how we handle that, once you see it, can kind of giggle at it, know what yours sounds like, and its favorite things to get you to not do what you said you'd do, is we get you into the right promises.
Okay.
To move your dream forward. You have a dream. So if my dream was to, write Maybe It's You, right? And I really had, I was on a crazy deadline. It was 6 months. I have never written a book before. I definitely know the method and I'm a writer. So it wasn't I didn't know I could do it.
Mm-hmm.
But now I had to do it and I had 6 months. So I really was in a promise. Same thing with my TV show of how many hours a day I was working on it, period.
Okay.
Or else, right? There's an or else. And that's the key to the Handel method, is because as much as we're good at keeping promises to other people, we suck at keeping keeping promises to ourselves.
Well, you bring up a good point. Yeah, a lot of people say, okay, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to run this much every day, or I'm going to sit down and write and work on this script for this amount. And then things come up, and it's easy to reprioritize. So what do you do in those moments? What is the so what? You know, like a
so the secret sauce, right? So the secret sauce to it all, which really had me like write and sell my TV show again based on nothing. Like I had no like, I'm always going to write her. No, right? I really at 40 decided I wanted to write a TV show, and I needed a promise and someone to hold me accountable to it, which was my baby sister, who's not easy on me. Okay.
Good.
And my promise in the beginning was really 2 hours a day, period. No matter what. Like, and I had young kids at the time, that I could easily blame them for why I can't write.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like we all do. And if I did not keep my 2 hour every day promise, I lost my glass of wine at night.
Oh.
Okay. Now you'd be like, that's so goofy, Marty. Like, really?
No,
like,
but you have to know what motivates you. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, here's like the fine print for human beings is our vices motivate us. Like, the threat of taking something away, like the promise of like glory and a TV show and all that would be lovely, but I really never had it, so I could live without it.
Hmm.
Especially if I put like feeling bad and guilt and blame and excuses in there, I'm okay. Right? Except now all of a sudden I was losing my like favorite 5 o'clock vice.
Losing your vice.
As sad as it is, I would fight more for my vice than my dream of a TV show.
Yeah, because one, you know what feels like, the other one, you don't. You don't have any experience with it. Interesting.
And I won't fight for it. Like, it's really goofy, but human beings will really fight for it more than, right? So, like, same thing with, like, sex with my husband. Like, I know that we'll be happier if I don't leave that out.
Sure.
And yet, I could leave that out, but I need a promise and a consequence.
We're visiting.
Because just feeling guilty. Just feeling guilty and blaming him for why not.
Yeah. We're
like, is it going to cut it? It won't have me step up and be the partner I want to be.
We're visiting with Marnie Neer, who is not only a life coach, but also she specializes in relationships and family. And we're talking about writing because you know, as you mentioned, at the age of 40, you said, you know what? I'm gonna write a TV show. Let's do this. Get on board, myself.
Yeah.
You know, let's do this thing. Now, I am curious to ask you, can anyone learn to write, or is there an innate ability that someone must have to begin with to be successful?
Look, I think it helps, right? Like that you think you have something to say,
mm-hmm.
right? Look, there's editors, there's copy editors, there's ghostwriters. Like, there's lots of possibilities out there to go get help, even if you don't think it's your gift. But you need to want to go share something and contribute to the world that way. Like, get it out of just being about you. And want to go make a difference. So really also in Handel, first step out of the gate is to write your dream, right? For every area of your life. And career is one of them. So I really had a dream of being, like back in the day when I first started getting coached by my sister, and she's like, what do you know, and all I had was, like most of our clients come in, like I knew what I didn't want to do.
Yeah, a lot of people can start from that. So you talk a lot about how you have to write your dream. What do you mean by that?
So out of the gate at Handel, first thing is everyone has to go write their dream, you know, kind of like a year from now, make it in the present tense, not someday, one day. It's this has happened, right? So in every area of your life you could think of, from career to family to your body to fun and adventure to spirituality, like we cover it all and get you starting to think and admit your dream. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Because human beings not only suck at keeping promises to themselves, we suck at admitting our big dreams. Okay, mm-hmm. Like when we were kids, we were great. We did like, you know, we have like tell you details of what we want and we'll have. But as we get older, we only want what we think we can have.
Hmm.
So we get very miserly and chicken about it. So back when I first started writing and admitted that I wanted to be a writer, and I had evidence, like the minute you stand in your dream, I could really go back and prove that when I was 10, I used to write plays with my friend Debbie Landau. So it wasn't like I couldn't go prove it, that it was always there, but my chicken wouldn't really let me until I admitted that I had a dream. So my sister, who was working on me in my career, because at that point I had just had kids, I was, homemaker, not that happy, quickly turning into my mother. But I knew I didn't want to go back to work. I just knew what I didn't want. And my sister made me write a list of what possibly could I do that would make me really happy. And back in that time, Sex and the City, the TV, on HBO was the biggest thing. And I remember looking at, Cary Bradshaw, right, and going, wow, I want to do what she does. Right. And I'm God help everyone. I'm not writing a sex column, but I could go make fun of this pro bono gig of being a parent that I suck at. Right. And I don't get paid enough for, but I also suck at. And could I go do that? And from there, I started made a couple phone calls, and I wasn't, I was doing it for free. But in the Westport News, I had my column called The Poo, because I really felt I was speaking for every mom. So and it really just took it from there.
Wow.
It's encouraging to know that, if we feel like we have something to say, we likely have something to say. And knowing that, who are you to have done what you've done? Well, you're just someone who said, yeah, I'm going to do it and committed to it. Now, in sort of closing with you, I'm curious, we have word that you're writing a play. What is that all about?
I'm not allowed to say the title because it's punchy. So but I'm writing, I had this idea as I was sitting getting an ultrasound and a mammogram and everything that most, every 40-plus woman does yearly if we're wise, right? So I'm sitting in that office, and I can't tell you how many years I've been sitting in that office having the same idea but doing nothing about it, okay? Mm-hmm. But I'm if I just could record what my head is doing during this two-hour ride, it's amazing, right? It's so awful. Right, I'm going to die. I go through so many phases of being me. Right, I judge the heck out of everybody else in that waiting room. I don't speak to anyone. I make jokes to myself about the prevention magazine that's next to me or the stupid 100-calorie packs. Mm-hmm. And then I laugh at the artwork. And, it's a ride.
Yeah, right? It is a ride.
And it's a ride. So that was my idea. Again, kick my butt to go get busy on it. Just like a TV show, I have never written a play before, but like anybody else, there really is it's not an idiot's guide, but go read three plays, Marnie, and see what they look like.
Hmm.
Right. And that's all I did because again, I had something that I knew, was too funny and universal to not go nail and teach about what we humans do for a living and what our heads do in that waiting room that causes, it should be much more fun to be us than it is. And the getting, right, and the getting, conscious of it, right? It's called Higher Consciousness, right? So it's not an uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So that's the name of the play. And I call it a mammalogue because it's a one-woman show.
That's amazing.
It's a lot. It's fun. And so I wrote that. The first draft is done. I've sent it out to a bunch of people. I'm getting notes and more brave things I do a day that I don't want to do for it, the more I think it'll happen.
I love that, though. That's great advice as for a writer as well.
A very inspiring story. Cool to know that you talked about those office visits. I'm betting you've done those for maybe 1 year now. And to be able to write a play about that experience just in 1 year's time, very significant. Maybe I'm off on the year. Maybe it's been more than 1 year. That's a conversation for a different time. Marnie Neer is a life coach at Hondale Group who specializes in relationships and families. She's also chief content officer, currently writing that play. Excited to see what comes with that. You can follow Hondale Group on Instagram at Hondale Group, HANDELGROUP.
Coming up next, are you looking for ways to avoid burnout and find a better work-life balance? Well, we're going to tell you about some simple things you can do.
This may be one of the first steps to the downfall of the movie house industry. Oh. Where are you going to be okay? We'll talk about it coming up in your Morning Buzz. You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Welcome back to the Lisa Show. You know, coming up in about 20 minutes, we're going to do a little show check-in. But first, right here, right now, we've got your morning buzz with Richie T.
It's three things that are trending online right now. This first story, pretty sad. 13 people killed when an SUV was struck by a semi-truck in California's Imperial Valley. The people that are believed to be among dozens of undocumented migrants who entered the United States through a hole in the border fence with Mexico. At least 44 people had managed early this past Tuesday morning to enter the U.S. through a 10-foot breach in the border fence. Surveillance footage reviewed by border agents shortly after 6 a.m. showed two separate vehicles leaving the area where the fence was breached in what officials are investigating as smuggling events. One vehicle, a maroon Ford Expedition, was carrying 25 people when it was struck just after 7 a.m. 25 people in a Ford Expedition and got into a car accident. Several ejected, obviously, because there's not 25 seatbelts in a Ford Expedition. This is an interesting video trending over on YouTube. It's called Teaching Jake About the Camcorder, and it's tagged with the date January 1997. It's a fun look.
Back in time.
The old Zoom feature of the camcorder and how you couldn't hit record if you'd rewound because then you would record over your precious memories. And it's the trials of yesteryear gazed through the lens of 2021. And it's pretty funny. It's from a channel called Brian David Gilbert, which I'm guessing is the gentleman's name whom you see within it. But it's called Teaching Jake About the Camcorder. Gather your kids around for a history lesson. And then finally this, maybe gather the kids and tell them the history about how you used to go to movie houses to watch movies.
Yeah.
The Alamo Draft House, the popular Austin-based restaurant theater chain, places where you could eat food in the theater. Oh. I've actually been to the Alamo Draft House before. I remember the Alamo Draft House, too, if you want to go there as well.
That's so sad. Everyone is probably just, you know, kind of understands it, but sure, also is super disappointed.
Yeah, declaring bankruptcy, this they're saying is likely the outcome for several movie theater chains. Not going away, but we will see it contract significantly from how it was in the past. The days of your multiplexes soon to be gone. That's just me. That's just me postulating. But the Alamo Draft House,
for sure,
also backing it up and saying, hey, you know what? We got to do this to be able to continue claiming Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Hey, there you go. That's your morning buzz. Sorry it wasn't happier.
Thanks, Richie T. Now, today we're excited to talk with author Charlene Walters, who's a trainer and entrepreneur coach. You know, we have a lot of conversations, I think, not only at work, but as we're, you know, walking in our neighborhoods here and there about that kind of achieving the elusive work-life balance, right? Mm-hmm. And avoiding burnout. I think we've come a long way with having conversations that don't, you know, glorify working yourself to death, but really trying to achieve that and having more of that financial confidence and making your career goals come true. So we're really excited to be able to have this conversation with her because she has a new book that's out that's based on 10 mindset shifts that help women just to be a little bit more successful, not only in the business world, but not ignoring the personal life aspect of it. This helps not only with a mindset, but can help those kinds of conversations as we sort of, we don't do anything alone and independent in this. Welcome, Charlene. Thank you for being here to have this conversation. Hello?
Oh,
I think we're having a hard time getting Charlene on. As we try to connect with her here this morning, I do want to say, too, that this is something that I've spent a lot of time thinking about. You know, when you want to have a business and start it, and there's so many things that you have to consider. And for women in particular, you feel like a lot of times there's more expected, you know, to be successful right from the beginning, or there's an additional pressure, especially where kids are concerned. And if you are a mom or if you have that
sort of balance in your head, being able to not only explain it to others, but be able to discover what's important to you and prioritize are two different things.
I think we have Charlene. Let's try her again. Charlene, are you there?
Hey, how are you guys today?
Great. Good, and we're glad that we finally connected with you. Thank you for being patient with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. We sort of queued up this conversation with talking about that elusive work-life balance, especially for women and as they start down a pathway of beginning a new business or a side hustle. There's so many things to consider. When someone comes to you and asks for your advice on where to start, where do you direct them?
So I tell them the best way to start is to take hold of that schedule. You know, it's really true that women often have higher demands placed on them, balancing their business, balancing their families, and they want to be the best at everything. And we're not superwomen, so we've got to kind of pick and choose. So I tell them to kind of critically analyze their schedule, see where they're spending their time, see where they can look for holes. And the best thing to do is to dedicate certain hours as much as possible to your business and certain hours to your family. I'm a single mom, and I find that if I communicate with my children, they have things they want to do. And if I just simply tell them, okay, I'm working during these hours, and then we have, you know, 6 to 8 or 8 to 9 to run your errands or do exactly what you want, and I'll spend time with you, it makes it that much easier. It's just really about communicating, scheduling, and then trying as much as possible to find that balance.
Speak a little bit more about these habits that you have incorporated in your life that have helped you achieve your goals.
So what I tell many women, and I try to do myself, is to really make sure you're also finding time for yourself, because as women, we put ourselves last. We have so many things to do. We're running around like crazy sometimes, and we forget to take care of ourselves. But the more well-rested we are, the more we eat healthy foods and drink lots of water and find times for those things that are important to us, the better off we are for our families, for our business, for everyone. So I really try to make fitness and doing things and activities that I love important. And I also really try to balance my family. You know, sometimes you can't stick on that perfect, you know, whatever it is, 8 to 6 schedule. You've got to take a little break if there's something to do with your children, and that's okay. You can always come back to it. And one of the great things about being a business owner is that you have that flexibility and you can make those shifts when you need to.
So this sounds like pretty great advice for just anyone, right? Mm-hmm. Whether you're just in a couple or you have kids, being able to dedicate not only time to yourself, but to your work and also to your relationship. So what's that extra piece that applies to being an entrepreneur or that kind of flexes us into more of these mindsets that you're talking about?
So the book is really based for women on areas that they struggle with more, but I've talked to many men who've read the book and they say, you know, I have some of these same issues. So other areas that I dive into are imposter syndrome, which is more prevalent for women. It's that feeling that they don't really belong. They're lacking confidence. And women are taught often that they need to be perfect or close to perfect before they put themselves out there. It's just sort of our culture. And we can't be perfect when we're starting off in something new. You know, we've got a lot to learn. And entrepreneurship is one of those things. It's just a little bit difficult sometimes for women to want to put themselves out there. They feel like they're bragging. But as the head of a business, you really do need to put yourself front and center. I also talk about other areas such as building your brand, personal branding, another biggie for women. Cultivating financial confidence. Although women are capable with financial matters, sometimes, again, because traditionally we have less time, we've put less of an emphasis on that. So a little bit of advice about learning to love money and that money leads to success. So a focus on developing a selling mindset, because sometimes we have an adverse reaction to sales. We look at it like we're bugging, annoying someone, you know, but it's reframing the way we think to be more persistent and to understand that we're not really bugging or annoying someone. We have a product, a service, a message that's valuable. And I also devote a lot of time to really becoming more resilient, because that's one of the main reasons that businesses fail, is because they hit obstacles, setbacks, and we kind of get down, we lose our confidence, we lose our drive. And it's so important because we will fail and be rejected and hit those walls over and over again as entrepreneurs. So coming up with coping strategies for when we do is super key.
Now, Charlene, we've been talking about how to reframe sort of an entrepreneurship support system. But now I'd like to sort of expand the conversation to entrepreneurs as a whole. What do you think that we need to do to think differently as we are, you know, I was going to say start in 2021, where we've already started, but as we face a new business horizon?
So it's really interesting, you know, the way business have evolved. Obviously, last year, most businesses had to pivot, come up with new ways to reach their customers. You know, we got really creative in many cases. And now we're seeing markets change and shift. We're seeing an emphasis on, you know, I was talking to my plumber the other day, which is hysterical, but he's been so busy. People are in their homes more. So home decor, repair services, we've seen, unfortunately, divorce attorneys get super busy. Right now, we've seen counseling services. We've seen all of those things related to homeschooling and childcare. They're taking off right now. But I imagine in the future, we'll see industries such as travel, vacations really take off. So it's just about consistently pivoting, watching the changing market, and then really adapting to what your customers' needs are, because those are the things that are changing. And being creative and innovative when it comes to reaching customers has been important. And I'm hoping that many of the services that we've implemented over the last year will carry on into next year. I mean, as a backup, we never know when something else can happen. We never are quite sure now when things will be completely normal, if they're normal again. So really just using those things that we've done this year, carrying them on, and then adapting and pivoting as we do change and normalize.
I think sometimes we romanticize the idea of the entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And I think
the lifestyle.
Yeah. Being able to work for yourself. I'm not working for anybody.
I'm boss.
Yeah. And people that do that and work in these various industries that maybe shut down during the pandemic likely may be reconsidering going back and working for a company, a corporation, and other people, as you know, their corporations are saying, hey, come back to this building, have said, hey, you know what, I really like working for myself in my own space. How do you determine if someone has that entrepreneur mindset, or what qualities does a entrepreneur have?
So the most important thing to be successful as an entrepreneur is really to have that desire, that want to do it, because it's all about that tenacity and persistence. I think anyone can be an entrepreneur if they really, really want to. They have to just set their goals, really do their homework and research in the market they're entering, talk to that target audience, find out where they're congregating, survey, find out as much information as possible, and then start their planning and goal setting, and then have those micro steps and those action-oriented tasks so that they can make it happen. I always suggest starting as a side hustle when it's possible, because that mitigates some of the risk. You know, we really don't want to take that giant leap and give up that paycheck. But if we're already furloughed or laid off, this can be the time where we have all this extra time at home to really get our plans together and to make it happen. And then it's about having that resilience and coming up with strategies to deal with obstacles and setbacks, you know, just ways to reset your mindset so that you can keep moving forward. But I'm a firm believer, if you want to do it, do it.
You know, you brought up the idea of the side hustle, and I think this is an important point, because a lot of people can consider this, I think, more than quote unquote starting a business, because it seems like it's a softer lead in many ways. What is your opinion on the sort of commitment level and the way to start a side hustle so that it is taken seriously and you have that kind of tenacity and persistence with a softer lead-in?
So I think that the important thing is to really just do all that kind of development at the beginning. Set your business plan up, do the market research, and start setting up your website, your social media accounts, and start really formulating your plan for those revenue generating activities. I think you mentioned, Richie, earlier that we get caught up in the glamour of being an entrepreneur. It seems so wonderful, but really, And we see sometimes, I see new entrepreneurs who are focusing on everything else but those sales and revenue generation activities. They're putting up a beautiful website and they're making t-shirts and, you know, they're renting out a space. But really, we have to be really frugal in the beginning and get it going. And I think, you know, if we dedicate certain hours, nights, weekends, we can make it happen over time. The important thing is to set a goal. Maybe it's a sales goal. You want to be to a certain point in traction in your business. Maybe it's time. And some people might just want to have that side hustle forever as a way to make additional income. It really depends on the person.
When we look at the mindset shifts that you've written about within this book, you label 10, and I know that we've probably gone over, at least on some level, all of them. I always want to just list them and explain each and every one of them. We don't have the time to go in depth on all of them. Is there one that you would find to be most important to be able to share in the time that we have with you this morning?
So I talk about in one of the mindset shifts about developing an entrepreneurial attitude, and I think that's a big one. And that involves really thinking about and determining your why. Why do you want to start the business? Why did you pick the business you choose? What do you hope to accomplish? Knowing that will really help you understand your how and how you'll make it happen. Also, as part of that, you need to get more comfortable with risk taking, right? Because the more we put ourselves out there front and center, take those risks and fail, the more we learn. So that's important, as well as developing patience. You know, a lot of times when we're working on a project, we're working on a new business, we feel like we're sitting still. It's so frustrating. So I always encourage that entrepreneurs write down everything they're doing. And I do this myself. And then I'll flip back through and I'm shocked. This is what I was worried about a month ago. So really just paying your dues, understanding that it's going to take a while. It won't happen overnight. We see so many successful entrepreneurs and we think, wow, that was really easy, you know, but it's that old saying of that overnight success story that took 10 years. We don't see all that failure, all that rejection, all that heartache that went into it, you know, and then really just pulling on that belief in yourself, you know, knowing that you can do it, you have what it takes, trying to focus on the positive. And when something happens, an obstacle, a setback, as we know that they will, just finding a way to get unstuck and really overcome that and keep moving forward.
Well, how have your personal setbacks informed the way you approach these mindsets or even created them?
So my mindset, my experience, I'm a single mom, as I mentioned earlier. My husband passed away suddenly when my kids were 2 and 4. So I was completely shocked. My world turned upside down. I had these 2 toddlers. I was mid-PhD. I didn't think that I would be able to do anything. I didn't think I would finish the PhD. I didn't think I could take care of my kids. I didn't think I'd be able to go on to do all those things I could professionally. And because I had that experience, I, as anyone does with 2 toddlers, you can't exactly just say, hey, go make yourself breakfast and sit around and feel sorry for yourself. So I dug deep and I really developed more resilience and tenacity. And I think that's carried over into my life. I've done so many things now that I wouldn't have done otherwise. So I always like to tell people that entrepreneurship is never a straight line and that life is never a straight line or success. It's many ups and downs, zigs and zags. But if it's something that we desire to do, we'll get there. And other, you know, I'm also just really tenacious. If I want something, I am going to go after it with all my heart. And if I don't get it my first try, I'm going to find plan B, plan C, plan D, plan E, whatever it takes to get there. I think that's really important.
Your website is ownyourother.com. And I'm curious, what does that mean?
So that means I've written actually another book, a memoir on just my experience with my husband passing away and my kids being small. And really the title is Own Your Other, means own your alternate path. You know, that wasn't the path that I set out on. It wasn't the one that I wanted to be on necessarily. And it wasn't, I sort of fought it at first. It wasn't till I accepted it and owned it that I began to thrive. And so that's really the meaning of the site is no matter what direction life takes you in that you thought you wouldn't go, the more you accept it and make the most of it, the better off you'll be.
Well, thank you for your information and for sharing that part of your life with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. I like to do that just in case anyone is going through something similar so that they know that there are other people in the same situation.
Where can people find more information about you?
They can find out more at ownyourother.com. You can find out about my book, Launch Your Inner Entrepreneur, at launchyourinnerentrepreneur.com. And I am on social media everywhere as Charlene Walters, PhD, or C. Walters, PhD.
Thanks so much.
Now, coming up, we're going to do a quick check-in with the show. How are we doing? Listen, do we need to be held accountable? Is that what's coming? Is the day of reckoning at hand?
You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Welcome back to The Lisa Show.
You know, Richie, I always try to be helpful.
One word. Okay, that may not be the first word that comes to mind.
But if I was like
top five words, I would say Lisa is so helpful. She's always trying to be helpful. How is Lisa? Helpful. Very helpful.
No, I've been having a lot of conversations lately with a theme at work, at home, on my like family Marco Polo group, like you do, and have different like friend Zoom groups and things like that. And there's a theme coming up, and I don't know if it's pandemic related or stress related. At this point, who cares? It's all related, okay. I think. Okay. You know, sometimes we try to figure out, you know, where our problems come from, and sometimes you just need to solve the problem. And it's the issue of sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that a lot of people have been having a hard time sleeping lately, or waking up in the middle of the night, not being able to go back to sleep.
Yeah.
And it's something that a lot of people are worried about. And I think that sometimes our intuitive nature of what should I do if I wake up in the middle of the night is not necessarily the best advice. So in my quest to be helpful, I stumbled across an article in for CNN Health about how you can get back to sleep.
Okay. So this is, I've awoken for whatever reason in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. I need to be able to get back to sleep.
Yeah. To break habits. In fact, I think, interestingly, one of my friends has had such a hard time sleeping and having a sleep schedule that she's like trying to reset her sleep by using some medication and going to bed at an earlier time. And it's really regimented. That's under the advice of a doctor. So I'm not talking about, you know, if you have real health issues that need to be addressed by a doctor, but I'm just saying, hey, how about some tools in your toolbox?
For the casual sleeper.
For the casual sleeper. A little bit. I appreciate that.
And now Lisa Valentine Clark presents tips for the casual sleeper.
How to get back to sleep. And now some of these I've used and some of them I have not.
Okay, I'm ready.
Okay. Again, from a CNN Health article, the first suggestion that they have is to use deep breaths. So to pay attention to how you're breathing.
Okay.
Okay. So for me, I have tried this with success of sometimes when you feel anxious or panicked, you find yourself having shallow breaths like at the top of like, and you can feel it in your throat or the top, and you should be breathing deeply, especially when you're in a sleep state from your diaphragm or from your belly, right? And so taking a deep breath through your nose, holding it for a little bit and slowly exhaling through your mouth is one technique.
Okay. Okay. Pro tip, don't hold your breath for too long.
Yeah. No, don't.
Because then you'll fall asleep for anyway. Yeah.
Also, and I know a lot of people have tried this, guided sleep meditations and muscle relaxations. And I know you use guided sleep meditations.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. So the particular thing that we've talked about before is it's a 15-minute YouTube video that for whatever reason, like the sounds and tones and levels of this particular one that I've found, like cues into my brain. And I go, oh, I'm so wound up. I need to be able to within a minute's time.
So if you've never tried that, if you can ask your smart speaker to turn on a guided meditation or have one handy, I know that that helps.
Okay.
I've had several people in my life, friends and family, say, hey, yeah, I've used that. It's super great.
Yeah. I don't think that I personally could do one where someone is talking. You know, because in those guided ones, it's like, oh, make sure you breathe. And then breathe.
I focus too much on the voice part of it, but yeah. Just to have sounds and those tones and that kind of stuff, that can be really relaxing. But again, you find these things that are available for you. And
you can
the
go to YouTube and Spotify, and there's so many different resources that you can do.
There are applications on your phone which you can download and pay for.
And so knowing or anticipating it's going to be a problem and having those at the go so that you don't have to get up and turn on the TV or turn on your phone, but you just know where they are would be very helpful. That's just a suggestion. Another suggestion is, and I thought this was interesting because I had never considered this one. It's called Stop the Blame Game. Being nice to yourself instead of saying, oh, I shouldn't have eaten, you know, a heavy meal, or, oh, I'm too anxious and getting down on yourself about, like, why can't I sleep? I'm exhausted. I should be able to sleep. Oh, now I'm going to be tired tomorrow. Stop all of that.
Yum.
That none of that is helpful or productive. And being just kind to yourself of saying, I'm a human being. I'm doing the best that I can, you know, and like that kind self-talk can really have an effect on your sleep. I thought that was interesting.
I wake up in the middle of the night. It's okay that I woke up in the middle of the night.
Hey, all buddy. Right. It's all right.
Hey, pal.
Yeah.
Are we awake? Yeah. I guess
it's
we are.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's go back to sleep. What do you think, champ? All right, sport. Let's get back to sleep. Okay.
Now you got it. Now you got it. You're going to think about that. Okay. Another suggestion is don't drink alcohol before bed. And I don't drink, so this isn't a problem for me. But there are other habits that you can do that you think are going to relax you and help you wind down. But they were saying that actually can cause a more sleepless night. Mm.
Yeah, as I understand
it's kind of counterintuitive.
It can kind of help you get to sleep.
Yeah, but not
then,
stay.
Yeah, but not
That's
stay
what
asleep.
The article says. Another thing, this is number 6 for those of you keeping score.
Yeah,
at
these
home.
These are by the way, if you're just joining us, tips for the casual sleeper. These are not doctor necessarily prescribed things, but things if you find yourself sort of waking up in the middle of the night, you need to calm and coo yourself back to sleep. These are some things that you can do. Number 6, I'm ready.
And I do this. And this works for me.
Okay.
So this is if I had to put a little star next to this list, this is the one that I do.
Okay.
Write down your worries. Write them down.
So I wake up, oh my gosh, I've got so much to do tomorrow.
Or if you're like me, you're like, oh, I got to wake up because I can't forget that meeting. Or I have to do that one thing. Don't forget to change that appointment. Or don't forget that you have to pick up your kid at this time. You have all these things that your brain is like, don't forget. Remember, you told me it was important to remember. And you're like, yeah, brain, not now, though. Like now we're, you know. But if you, and I have a little notepad by my bed. And if you write down your worries, like, okay, tomorrow I have to do this. It's like a to-do list for me. I need to do this and this and this. It tricks your brain into thinking you've done something about it. Like, oh, good. She didn't forget. Mm. She got it. Okay, we've done our job. Now we can go back to sleep.
Okay.
So
that's
write
cool.
down so do you your worries.
Do you have like a notepad bedside?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
A couple of them.
How do you keep the pens? I think that like in the, you know, when, you know, you do the flailing arms when you're trying to turn the alarm off, that I would knock that pen somewhere. I'd always know where the pad is,
but couldn't
get a pen in the middle
of it. That's a really good question. I have a little tray, gold tray, this kind of oblong little one. And I put like a little notepad and I have some pens, some hair ties, some lip balm, maybe some lotion.
My hope was that you had like a bank pen with a chain somewhere next to your bed. So
that's a really good
idea.
So
that it couldn't go anywhere. It's just mounted. Yeah, sure.
It's not a bad idea. If that is a problem for you, then have a little tape.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So is there a number 7 on this list?
Yes, there's 8 of them.
Okay.
So we're almost done. Beware of blue light and that kind of stimulation. Now, you can buy for very cheaply on Amazon and your local pharmacy, just glasses with clear lenses that will block out that blue light from your phone or from the TV to help your brain, again, relax and not say, oh, here's this bright light. It's daytime. We got to get going. Right? Because that's your brain, again, hypervigilant, trying to protect you, trying to help out, sometimes creates that sort of anxiety if you look at your phone in the middle of the night or look at the TV. But if you have those blue light blocking glasses, that can help you calm down.
Also filters on your phone. Most phones have a little thing you can click on
now.
And then it turns off the blue light from your phone.
Luckily for me, my reading glasses, mm-hmm. you know, keep them by my bed.
Your readers? Do you
my
call
readers,
them your readers
not yet?
Yet,
but you're maybe not I should. I'm not there yet. I have that blue light filter. So consider that. Yep. And then the last one, and this is counterintuitive to me. This is the most surprising tip. If you need to get back to sleep, you don't know what to do. It says this CNN health article. So I'm assuming a doctor was
yeah, I mean,
at least...
you read it on the internet, so it must be at least somewhat true.
Get up after 20 minutes. If you have been struggling, tossing and turning. Mm-hmm. Oh, and another thing I should say, I think I skipped this one by mistake. Don't watch the clock.
Yeah.
But yeah, I know. Which is like saying, don't open your eyes. Yeah, like, well, we're just going to do it. Mm-hmm. But if it's been a while, like 20 minutes, you can get up. Mm-hmm. You could read, but maybe not your phone. You know, don't turn on that light, but read for a book, get up, get a glass of water or something like that. Stop fighting it. It was interesting. I met with a neurologist one time when my husband was having a really hard time sleeping, and we were trying to get his medication so he could sleep with anxiety and things like that. And my doctor actually said, the neurologist said, you know, back in the day, meaning in like the late 1800s, it was very common for people to have a first sleep and a second sleep. Hmm. So they'd go to sleep, right, like at a normal time or whatever. Then they would wake up maybe at like after 4 hours, like after a sleep cycle, and they would get up, go into the parlor and maybe read, maybe like do a little needlepoint or something like that. And then they would go back to sleep for what they would call second sleep. And it was actually quite common. And so that may be thinking about how, like, I have to go to sleep, I have to stay asleep for, you know, 8 hours uninterrupted, is it might be a little too much pressure and might not be the natural way that our bodies are used to it. And so kind of reframing the way you see sleep and saying that that's okay and calming down about it was actually something that was more socially appropriate back in the day.
Hmm.
Who knew?
I wonder if I can get second sleep, does that mean I can eat a fifth meal?
Well,
like if I wake up between first and second sleep, could I work in another? Can I just cram in another?
Yeah. Listen, I don't know.
So those are 8 tips according to CNN Health.
Yeah. I thought they were really interesting. I'm going to incorporate a couple of them in, and hopefully they'll help people get a little bit of a better sleep.
Yeah, so I was looking on the internet and found, according to RNN, which is the Richie News Network, a few extra sleep helps that were not mentioned in your list.
Oh, what did we leave out?
Well, they're from the internet,
okay.
So I want to make sure that everyone knows.
The Richie News Network?
Yeah, the RNN.
Cool.
So know your sources, everybody. but people maybe consider, you know, that I am a professional sleeper of sorts in that we have to get up to do this job very early in the morning.
Yeah, so there's a lot of pressure for
yes,
us to,
yeah.
like, go to sleep.
Yeah. So may I posit a few suggestions from the RNN,
please.
The Richie News Network. Clean sheets is more important than I think that you think for sleep. The actual hygiene of the area in mm-hmm. which you sleep. Being able to have it be dust free, as much as it can be, right? Home's full of dust, but if it can be clean and your sheets are clean, there may not be any science. Again, this is according to RNN.
Yeah, but this sort of aromatherapy,
yeah.
I think, is a great idea. Great idea.
A second thing that I actually picked up learning from the Lisa Show. If you guys haven't heard the Lisa Show, it's great.
So
a lot
good.
Of great tips. Setting a bedtime mm-hmm. alarm, similar to like how we have a wake-up alarm. Mm-hmm. I have found this to be tremendously successful, where if I know, say, tomorrow I have to get up at 4 in the morning, well, how much sleep do I want to get? I want to get 8 hours of sleep. So what time does that mean that I need to be going to bed? I need to be going to bed at 8. So if I'm going to go to bed at 8, that means I need to start my nighttime regimen at 7 p.m. And so if the alarm goes off at 7, I can go, okay, well, what do I need to start doing? I got to brush my teeth. I've got to pack my bag for tomorrow. I've got to, and all those things, so that when the appropriate bedtime to go to sleep, to get the proper amount of sleep to be able to exist as a human being occurs.
I like that. It's a routine.
Then I have that as part of
your
my
body
routine.
Goes, oh, yeah, yeah, I know what we're doing. Yeah, okay, we're, that makes sense.
And,
yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
Similar to a morning alarm where your body goes, oh, I know what this is. It's morning. You can train your body to go, oh, okay, yeah, I am getting a little tired. There are, and you mentioned with the example of your friend that there are some medications, and I'm not going to wander into that, but there are some herbal and other supplements that you can take. Melatonin first comes to mind, mm-hmm. That you can buy at any sort of vitamin or nutrition store, various doses, and be able to find what works best for you. It's non-addictive and can be a sleep aid. And to just sort of echo one of the ones of your tip,
yeah, what's
from,
your favorite?
From CNN, if you find yourself sort of awoken in the middle of the night and you're like, ah, I'm not going back to sleep, don't get up. And mm-hmm. here's why, right?
Okay.
I mean, eventually,
because this is one that I don't do.
Yeah. Here is why you should do it.
Okay.
If you have ever wanted to be awake and not have anyone bother you and just get stuff done that yeah. you want to do mm-hmm. in a time when you're rested and focused and there's not people online to distract you, people in house to distract you.
That's a good point.
Things that, I mean, you can't go to the store because the store is not open.
Yeah.
And I don't recommend, you know, like trying to make this a habit.
Do it all the time. Yeah. Right.
But if you find yourself waking up, that is the perfect time for you to be absolutely selfish and not feel bad about it, because you can do whatever you want and no one's going to be like,
yeah.
I can't believe you
took... I'm just going to sit here and read a book.
I can't believe you took 3 a.m. yeah. for yourself. How dare you? Shouldn't you have been... Nope, I should not have been anything. It is the greatest gift. Mostly the greatest yeah. gift. It's also it also will make you really tired the next night. But right. if you find yourself not being able to sleep, take it. Get up. Get out. Find what you can do.
Getting a good night's sleep and a good night's rest is something that is important to every single person, no matter what your age is, no matter what situation you find yourself in. And so I think talking about it and sharing good ideas and maybe switching it up if you need to in order to get that elusive good night's rest is so important, and I'm glad we're talking about it.
You know, similarly, though, I will say this.
Okay.
When we find ourselves talking about food here on the Lisa Show, I find myself really wanting to eat whatever that
yeah,
food is that we're talking
yeah.
about. And now that
sleepy?
We've been talking about sleep, like I'm looking around and I'm going, could I take a nap for a couple minutes there? Could I crawl underneath that and be able to just sleep? Just for a couple minutes, or the elusive parental, I'm just resting my eyes. Could I do that? I think that the answer is yes, but I'm going to have to maybe try that out today.
That's a different discussion. The whole like power nap and things like that. We'll save that for another time.
Sounds
but I
good.
Hope everyone can get a good night's sleep. Now, coming up next, we're going to tell you what you can do to help a kid who has low self-esteem.
You are listening to The Lisa Show.
Welcome to The Lisa Show.
Hi, this is Lisa.
Hey, it's me, Richie T.
You know what's good for you?
A bunch of things that I can do for the weekend.
Welcome to The Lisa Show. I'm Lisa Valentine Clark.
And I am Richie T.
Do you feel like all of your free time is taken up doing things on your phone? Well, coming up in about 20 minutes, we're going to tell you what you can do to stop scrolling and that scrolling from taking over your life.
The history of snacks. That's the topic for today's Morning Buzz as we celebrate a national holiday. We're going deep, deep into history to find out why we call them snacks and other interesting facts. Oh, that rhymed too. That's coming up on your Morning Buzz.
Now, while some of us wish our kids could stay little forever under our protective wings, we know that eventually they have to face the real world. So it's important that while we have them under our care, that we empower them with confidence to go out into the world and do what they need to do. And because as many of us adults know, there's no shortage of critics out there, and no one will believe in us more than we believe in ourselves. So the question is, how can we make sure that we're raising strong, competent kids who will be ready to face anything? Well, here to give us some advice and to have a conversation about how we can raise more confident kids is Dr. Magdalena Battles. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
What are a few things that we could start doing right now to really help ensure that our children are developing more confidence in themselves and their abilities?
Well, there are a few things we can do right now in the present, starting today. And one is to stop trying to control our kids and instead start coaching them. They need us to be their encourager and their supporter and to coach them on things. So, for example, if our child is doing is wanting to cook and they're wanting to do a recipe, they pull out the box of cake mix and they're ready to do it, and you see that, oh, they're not even reading the directions. They're just going to dump it in and kind of guess what measurements go in things. Well, we need to coach them. We're not going to set them up for failure. We're going to coach them and not just try to control the situation and swoop in either and say, here, this is what you need to do. Say, honey, do you think maybe you should read the directions on the box? And they might go, oh, I didn't know I was supposed to use that. Like, yes, here's the directions. Here's where they're at. It's going to give you, you know, the exact measurements. And then let them go for there. So you empower them to do things on their own by providing some coaching and support, but you're letting them do it in the end.
So question about that, because we say, hey, this is where the instructions are, and then we watch them, and they don't follow them. And
yeah,
we
I have
go,
a couple kids who would follow, a couple who wouldn't.
Yeah. Oh, but if you do it that way, and then we just sort of let them fail?
Yeah. Yes, we do. We do. We can provide coaching, and we can provide support, but at the end of the day, it's up to them whether they want to follow that coaching. And it's okay for our kids to experience failure, because then they learn, oh, what do I need to do next time to make this a success? And then you can talk that through with them and say, well, you know, what do you think you should have done? And then they might say, oh, yeah, probably should have followed those directions. So it's a learning experience.
Is there any preparatory sort of instruction or best habits that we can do to ensure that our kids are going to be confident when we're not around them?
You know, that's the part of confidence that it comes from within. So it's something we want to build at home and under our guidance, so that when they do go out in the world, they do have confidence. One of the things that we can do is praising their effort, not the outcome. So when we're when they're out there on their own, we want them to have some positive self-talk going on that they've already experienced from us. You know, it's that voice in their head that we've repeated things so many times that when they're out there during a game, they can hear that. You know, mm-hmm. They can hear your voice saying, I'm a smart kid, I'm hard, I'm hardworking, I'm brave, I can do this. And it's the praising the effort, not the outcome. It's not, you can get this goal, you're going to do this, you're going to win the game. Because if we just praise the outcome, then their confidence is going to get defeated over time, because they're going to have more failures than they are successes in life. So we want to praise that effort, because that is what will build their confidence and help them pick themselves up and try again.
What are some things that parents unintentionally do that sort of undermines their kids' confidence?
Well, one of the biggest things is praising the outcome or you know, pushing for the outcome. Like, you need to get an A on this, and you know, if you don't get an A on this, that's not good. You should be able to get an A on this. Or saying, you're going to win this game. This is an easy team to beat. You better beat them. You know, that can undermine their confidence, because if they do, you know, not make the grade or they do lose the game, they're going to say, oh, I'm a loser. I'm a failure. No, it's, and they aren't. We need to tell them, no, did you do your best? Did you try your hardest? And ask those sort of questions and tell them, yeah, you did a great job because you tried hard. This team just came out and did better this time. You know, they may not have been as good last time, but wow, they really tried hard, but you did your best too. And that's what matters.
We're talking about
one of the biggest mistakes is not praising the effort. Mm-hmm.
With Dr. Magdalena Battles about raising confident kids, I would bet that you probably get a little bit of pushback on that last idea of praising results, because people would say or think they're saying, well, I want them to strive to be an A student to try and win the game. If I just encourage them to do their best, how do they set their sights beyond what they already are? What do you say to those folks?
Yes. Well, I would say, you know, they're going to lose more than they are going to succeed. So we don't want to set them up for feelings of being a failure. And so it is praising the effort. And you know, it's not. My husband is one of those people, too. He's like, no, we want to tell them to win. And I'm like, yes, it's a good thing to win. And you can say, congratulations, you won the game. I'm proud of you. But you follow up with, I'm so proud of you that you won the game, because you tried so hard, because you put the effort in and you did your best. So, you know, it is, you can recognize that they won and that they got that A, but you're recognizing why it happened, and it is their effort that made that happen.
Just recently, I was talking to one of my friends, and he's kind of struggling with his kid who's particularly shy and won't try a lot of things. How does this sort of advice, translate if you have a really shy kid?
That is hard, but you need to let the child take the lead and figure out what they like to do. Because in order for the child to gain confidence, they need to find their own niche, find what they love to do. It's not a good idea to push kids into things that they're not going to want to do. And there's a difference between, you know, a child saying, oh, you know, you enrolling them in something and then they change their mind. Let them finish the season and do it. But don't, if your kid says, I don't want to play the clarinet, I've never wanted to play the clarinet, don't sign them up to play the clarinet. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to just be setting up for failure. So help, help them find what they like. And sometimes that takes some digging. It takes some conversation and experimenting in different things. And so you may not want to sign them up for soccer or baseball or whatever right off the bat. You might want to say, hey, let's go out and throw the ball around and see if this is something you like to do. Or go and kick a ball around, whatever it is, and maybe get some friends together to try it out to see if it is something that they like before signing them up for a whole season. Mm-hmm. So they need to experiment and find things that the child does like, and then ask them, is this something you would like to pursue? So you really have to put it back in the kid's court, and you shouldn't force them to do things that sign them up for things that they really don't want to do.
So on the flip side of that, is too much confidence a thing?
Yeah, there are narcissistic personalities out there. We obviously see that. And I would say one of the contributors to that is perhaps parents that are praising their kids over every little thing, and they make their kids think that the world revolves around them. So we don't want to be one of those parents that praises our kids for every little thing. There is a point of overpraise, and I know that's a controversial thing as well. But, I mean, if my child is supposed to pack their lunch for school and, you know, it's something they've already gotten praise for that, you know, in the process of the first, you know, few weeks of school, they were learning to do it and they accomplished that goal. Well, I don't have to keep praising them every day throughout the whole year.
Right.
You know, it's sort of like it's an expectation. You know how to do it. So I don't need to praise every little last thing that you do. You know, we don't praise our 10-year-olds for going potty on the toilet. You know, eventually we go, oh, okay, they're potty trained. We don't need to keep praising that years from now. So, but there are parents out there that take it to the extreme and praise every little last thing their kid does and makes the kid think that the world revolves around them and they are the best at everything. And we need to let our kids know, you know what? You aren't going to be the best at everything. There are kids who'll be better at different things, and then you'll be better at different things. And that's okay, you know, because we were made that way. We weren't all made to be the best at everything.
I do like the idea of the parent who, with the teenager, say, that has their driver's license. Way to go, using the bathroom this morning. Yeah. Good job. Way to,
like, it's really going to confuse your kid.
To me, that's like, wait, I mean.
What? Okay.
So the narrative that comes to my mind when we have these types of conversations is, okay, I need to challenge my kid, but not challenge my kid too much. And I need to be positive, but not too positive, because life can be sort of things.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I need to make sure that I hug them, but I don't need to hug them too much, because and it's just all these things.
Yeah.
Those parents that have such anxiety around their kids, like they're going to mess them up. because they either do too much or too little of things. What do you say to those parents who just want the best for their kids?
I would say, you know what, it's all about balance. And if you have in your mind that recognition of, oh, I shouldn't do this too much, but I shouldn't do it too little, you're already recognizing that there is a balance. Because a lot of parents who are doing it wrong have zero recognition that there's a balance. They think, oh, well, I should continually praise my kid, and there is no limit to the amount of praise that that I should give my child, and I should praise every last thing. Those type of parents who don't recognize that there is a balance to things, they're the ones that are going to be having difficulty with their kids later on. So, you know, if they're recognizing that there is a balance, then they're half the battle. You know, that's half the battle.
So when we think about collectively all the things that we're trying to teach our kids or instill in them, what role does confidence play as they're moving forward? How important really is it in sending them out into the world?
It's hugely important. And one of those key terms that's out there right now is grit. We want kids that can persevere and get through things and have this grit. And confidence and grit go hand in hand. And confidence is in having that grit is being able to pick yourself up after failures and try again. So we really want to help teach our kids that, you know, yes, you are going to fail, and that's okay, because you're going to learn how to pick yourself up. We're going to talk about what we can do better next time, and then you're going to try again. And that's what life is about. It's not about succeeding every single time, because that is reality. We will have failures. And so we need to know how to push through those failures and pick ourselves up and try again. And that is what confidence and grit are all about.
Well, I appreciate you acknowledging that it's an ongoing effort. I feel like a lot of, you know, parenting sort of things that we want to instill in our kids, whether they're qualities or habits, we feel like, well, did I do it? Is it done? Is it, you know, and you know, I, like many people, have kids of different ages and some, you know, in different developmental, you know, sort of categories and things like that. And it is an ongoing, you know, trait that I want them to continue to develop, even as they sort of have one foot in the house and one foot out.
Yes, absolutely. It's ongoing. It's we're never done with this sort of parenting, even when our kids become adults. You know, we want to help them in adulthood too. So it's just an ongoing thing. And because just as adults, the confidence that we have in life can ebb and flow. So having parents that are good at being encouragers and coaches, even as we move into adulthood, that's the wonderful thing.
And also to be able to have that consistency, because I'm of the parental mindset where I say, well, didn't I do that once? Do I have to keep doing this? Oh, I guess I have to continually coach and help.
Welcome to parenthood.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. I know. Yeah, that's parenting. It's never ending. It's day and night, night and day.
Dr. Battles is a psychologist and an expert on parenting and child development. You can find out more about her and her work by going online to livingjoydaily.com. Dr. Battles, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Now, coming up, we're going to tell you the simple key to creating a little more free time in your day.
The history of snacks is on board for the morning buzz this morning. Do not go anywhere. Why do we even call them snacks? Answers right after this. You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Welcome back to The Lisa Show. Now, are you thinking about gardening, but you don't even know where to start? Well, don't worry. In 20 minutes, we're going to break down what it takes to plant a beautiful vegetable garden. But first, we've got your morning buzz with Richie T.
It's three things that are trending online right now. Folks are talking about these things. Your buddy Adam Levine is in the trending category this
from
morning.
From Maroon 5?
Yeah,
My brother's little garage band?
Yeah. Him and his buddies, they play.
Yeah, they play some music.
For people who don't know, Lisa's brother is in the band Maroon 5. Yeah, Adam Levine is trending. He was interviewed because he has a new song, Beautiful Mistakes, Maroon 5 does, right?
It's
partnered
exciting.
Up with Megan Thee Stallion. Think of Savage from TikTok, that's Megan Thee Stallion. He was interviewed, and he's very sad that there are no bands anymore, and people are running with the fact that he said that. Why does Adam Levine think there's no bands anymore? There's lots of bands, but that's trending.
Yeah.
Is this a band, Adam?
I know what
he means. Is Maroon 5 a band, Adam? So, trending online, your friend Adam Levine. Also this, Without Remorse on Amazon Prime. Okay. It's a spinoff of the Jack Ryan film series.
It is?
Starring Michael B. Jordan. A handsome Michael B. Jordan. Comes out on Amazon Prime in April, and the trailer is trending online.
I'm going to have to check that out.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you just go, oh, lots of action, lots of shooting, lots of this, and Michael B. Jordan. Yes, please and thank you, said many people. And then finally this, the history of snacks.
Oh, because I am here for this.
Today is National Snack Day. You know it's a Dutch word? It comes from the Dutch word schnacken.
No, it does not.
It does, in fact.
Oh, this is so fun. We're going to have fun with this all day.
Which means to bite. In 1402, the word appeared in English as a noun.
Well, good for the Dutch.
The first snack food in the United States was the peanut.
Oh.
It arrived shortly after the Civil War. As the popularity spread from the South to the North, they eventually became popular at baseball games and in vaudeville theaters. Hence, buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. Other snacks such as popcorn, pretzels, and peanuts were seen as being lower class foods and were sold from street vendors during the second half of the 19th century. So let us go further into snacks, shall we, please?
Please.
If people say, could you go back into one moment in time, where would you go? You know, that casual dinner conversation. Mm-hmm. I would go to the St. Louis World Fair of 1904 because introduced at that World's Fair was cotton candy. The first time we experienced cotton candy on large scale.
Can you imagine never seeing it and then
hot dogs, waffle cones, hamburgers. Also, right around that time, Jell-O was invented and brought to us. Also, the Oreo cookie and the individually wrapped chocolate tasty cakes.
It's like life began.
Snacking gained popularity during the Prohibition era. Pretzels became more accepted by the higher class.
I love that snacks are like a lower class.
Prohibition and the Great Depression brought us the Butterfinger, Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, Twinkies, Snickers, Fritos, Ritz Crackers, Lay's Potato Chips.
Oh,
I don't know why we call it the Great Depression when you have such inventions like that. During World War II, rationing of foodstuffs such as meat, butter, and sugar was part of the war effort, so there weren't very many new snacks that were introduced.
Not good ones.
However, what did come out of World War II?
What?
M&Ms.
Really?
Also, Cheetos were an example of a snack that came right after the end of the war. We're going through the history, kids. Hang on.
Now I'm super hungry.
Right around 1970, we get the introduction of Pop-Tarts, Pringles, Doritos, Hunt's Snack Pack Pudding, Gatorade, Combos, Reese's Pieces, Fruit Roll-Ups, and Teddy Grahams. Today, my good Americans, 4.3 billion pounds of snack food are purchased a year. 17 pounds of snack food a person per year. The most popular snack, still the potato chip, which we gobble over.
Now think about that, though.
6 pounds a person each year.
6 pounds of potato chips. I mean, potato chips are light.
Yep.
This is a lot of potato. I salute us all.
Other big snack foods that we as Americans consume on mass quantity.
Yeah.
Nuts, microwave popcorn, and corn chips. So grab a handful of your favorite snack
of choice. What are you going to grab today?
Well, listen, I think I'm going to try and do every single one of the snacks because I don't want to dishonor something on this national holiday. That is your Morning Buzz.
Thanks, Richie T.
These days, it feels like we're busier than ever. We're juggling being our kids' tutors, working from home where everything takes twice as long, and trying to be full-time chefs and maids and maybe getting a few minutes of exercise. Leisure time, ironically, sounds like a distant dream from the pre-COVID era.
I'm sorry, what is this?
I know.
Leisure.
I feel so guilty doing it. When we do manage to steal 30 minutes or an hour here or there for ourselves, we want to make sure we're maximizing it. But it always feels like something keeps popping up during our precious hour of me time, or someone popping up here to talk to us about what might be ruining our free time.
And how to avoid the trap of time confetti is social psychologist and Harvard Business School assistant professor, Dr. Ashley Willens. Welcome, Dr. Willens. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so can you first of all explain to us what time confetti is?
Yeah, so time confetti is one of the number one reasons that all of us feel so time poor, that we feel overwhelmed by the demands of work and life. Time confetti is the idea that when we used to have 1 hour of leisure to enjoy, that 1 hour is now being distracted and broken up into a lot of unenjoyable moments that become easily squandered and lost.
Oh, wow. When you explain it like that, I think, oh, I know exactly what you're talking about. I've never heard that term before. So why don't you give us some examples of time confetti, or what that looks like in a day?
Yeah. So you might have that 1 hour of precious time after you put the dishes away after dinner and you sit down to enjoy yourself and some either me time or family time on the couch. And then your phone goes off. You get a couple of emails and you go, oh, maybe I should check them. Mm-hmm. And then you check them. And then that's all of a sudden pulled you out of this present moment of trying mm-hmm. to have a nice quality time with your family. And it's actually undermined the amount of leisure time now that you have available. So you go ahead, you check that those couple of work emails, which inevitably results in a couple more work emails in response to what you just sent. And then onward and onward all day in all of our leisure time that is, again, part of the reason we feel so time poor is that we kind of let our free time be controlled by our technology and our work email.
You get that work email and then you realize you have to call Lisa, and then you get Lisa on the phone and she doesn't stop talking.
Good luck getting her
off. An hour later, it's like, yes, I recognize I've got to move along. All joking aside, how do we just not do that? Because the tendency, especially here in America, where we need to be right on top of it and get right back and make sure that people know that we are standing by, especially in a time that we're so grateful to have our jobs where other people don't have them. And if we don't have gratitude for it, someone else can fill the position because lots of people are looking and all these things. How do we stop the madness?
I think this is a really important question. There is a million and one reasons, especially in the U.S., especially right now, that we feel like we need to be always working, or at least giving the appearance of always being working.
Yeah.
Just to keep our bosses happy. I think this is where it becomes really important to think about time, not just as an individual resource to manage, but as a collective resource. Can you and your colleagues agree to have a couple of hours of email free time where you all won't email each other collectively? That's one way to get each other off the clock, is to agree on a couple of red light hours, if you will, where all of you are going to be heads down either on work or prepping dinner, and you promise that you won't be distracting each other. In the absence of that, turn off your phone, throw it in the bottom of a bag and put it in a closet and then lock the closet door. It will require you to take so many steps to get your phone that you probably won't do it. And you probably will think, it's not that urgent. It can wait an hour or so until I'm done whatever I'm doing. Just building in these small frictions to help you not engage in this immediate response of going to your technology can also be really helpful.
And I hear what you're saying, and I agree with it. But boy, that is really uncomfortable, right? Putting our phones away entirely. Because I always think, well, what if there's an emergency? Well, what I want my kids to be able to get a hold of me, you know. But yet, my time is fragmented because of that notification. And I think, oh, I'll just take care of that really quick. Oh, yeah, I'll answer that really quick so that I don't have to do it later. And then I find myself in a time confetti kind of situation. Are there certain tricks or settings we can put on our phone or something to, you know, make it a little bit easier than just, you know, locking it in a safe?
So there are tech devices that you can put in your house that will automatically turn the Wi-Fi of everyone's devices that are synced to this application that will automatically turn off your phone when you go into the living room, for example. Like it'll turn the Wi-Fi off on your phone. So I think relinquishing control to a situational strategy isn't something we're very good at. So my PhD student has research suggesting we prefer to accomplish our personally important goals ourselves, but we're actually much more successful when we hire help to help us, like getting a tech app or paying someone to help us reach our fitness goals, we're much more likely to actually achieve our goals. But we're kind of resistant. So I would kind of overcome our guilt and overcome our resistance to getting someone to help us and pay to have a tech app that automatically turns Wi-Fi off in your phone when you're in the living room, or another kind of blocker device that will prevent you from looking at Instagram or doom scrolling during the workday. Paying to commit ourselves to engaging in less technology has been shown in really rigorous empirical studies to help us stay more on task and be less distracted.
Wow.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Ashley Willens from the Harvard Business School about time confetti, which if I could make a time confetti cake, that just sounds to me like a delicious, delicious afternoon snack that would, you know, put to bed all the anxiety
whatever
and stuff like that.
Whatever helps you to really, like, visualize.
You know,
this.
She's talking about paying a little bit, maybe get these apps that would help us. Here, here is, and Dr. Willens, if this is your first time listening to the Lisa Show, you should know that I am the king of out-of-the-box ideas that, you know, sometimes they're a little extreme, but they are always helpful. I just want... Explore this idea.
Okay, I'm listening.
You and your partner, you have a real, real bad way of being addicted to your phone.
Okay.
Well, you put one of those 4-digit passwords on your phone, and you only know 2 of them, and your partner knows the other 2. That way, if you need to get into your phone, you have to get your partner's permission, who can then hold you accountable for extreme cases only.
I love that. I think it would definitely work.
Well, I really like this.
And I think if you add this financial incentive on top of it.
Okay. There you go.
Your partner gives you the last 2 digits and you have to give your partner money or a back rub or a promise to their favorite meal out.
See, I like the way she thinks.
I like that.
Lisa was listening to that going, I'm not so sure.
I don't know.
And she's a doctor.
I know.
Lisa.
I know. Well, our kids are looking at us too, right? You know, they're looking at how does mom, you know, figure her time? How does she spend her time? What is she doing? And they mirror us. And so we want to be a little bit more mindful of this. Is this an issue of not just technology, but like planning or just being more intentional about how we schedule our day?
Yeah, so one thing I talk a lot about in my research is the fact that we aren't very good at observing small moments of free time on an everyday basis that go missing. If we get overcharged $5, $10, $50, we notice that and we become viscerally upset. But when it comes to small losses of free time, we don't actually kind of track them in the same way. So a lot of my research is really just asking people to become more mindful about the way that they spend time on an everyday basis. Where do you waste 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 30 minutes on social media scrolling? And could you substitute those minutes for more positive and pleasurable activities? A short walk, calling a friend, looking online where you could volunteer some of your free time on the weekend or plan your next family outing. There's a lot of time that we have throughout the day that often goes missing and that we just fill with urgent but not necessarily important tasks like clearing our inbox.
Is there something in this research that you have discovered that you've really remedied in your own life and have found, you know, better use of your leisure time?
So I think there's really 2 components. So the first thing is you need to change your mindset and become more time aware. Mm-hmm. One thing that I've done in my own life is disrupt my initial habits. When I roll out of bed, I don't go straight to my inbox. I, on purpose, don't let myself check my work inbox until about 30 minutes after I've gotten up. It forces me to focus on other things other than work at the very beginning of the day, and it makes me more aware of how I'm spending my time throughout that entire day. If I go straight to work, then I'm in that mindset all day long and don't really come up for air. But if I focus on doing something pleasurable, pleasant, meaningful, like reading, going outside, then I bring an entirely different mindset to my day. Microsoft recently picked up on this because one of the things that's going missing in the virtual work from home environment is breaks, boundaries, and transitions. So I used to write about quite a bit that commutes are some of the most unpleasant moments of our day, but they also serve as a really important transition point from our work to our personal lives and back again. And that has gone missing. And so you could even think about kind of recreating a commute. So Microsoft recently put virtual commutes on all of their employees' calendars to
encourage a virtual commute.
Yeah, to encourage employees to get some active leisure or do something social, fun before delving into work for the day.
I love that idea. In my mind, I envision the businessman or woman putting on their business clothes and then taking a stroll around the neighborhood and then coming to their house like it's their place of business. Well, I guess I'd better get down to it and then sort of plop down.
But it sets the stage.
Yeah.
It gets you ready mentally and physically. I mean, why didn't we think about that before?
To me, one of the big takeaways that I gained from what you've said is that we just don't have an awareness and an appreciation of time. Mm-hmm. When one of the things I most recently watched The Social Dilemma, which if people don't know, it's a documentary on Netflix where they part of this this documentary, they talk to people and they say, how long do you think you were on your phone?
Yeah.
You know, on those social media apps. And it's like, oh, probably like, you know, 30 minutes, something like that. And some people were as much as 6, 7, 8 hours on their phone. But really being aware, I think, is the first step to making any sort of progress with this.
Absolutely. And this brings me to the second point I wanted to make, which is once you gain this awareness of how you're losing time in small moments each day, either all that time you spend checking your phone while you're trying to enjoy family time or checking email through these breaks that you might have otherwise had in the day, like commuting or lunch breaks, which we no longer have. It's also really important to take that knowledge and put it into action by making implementation intentions. Mm-hmm. Put small reminders of ways that you can fill your time in positive or meaningful ways in 5-minute, 30-minute, 1-hour increments, and then stick that reminder. I call this a time affluence to-do list, but you can stick that reminder on your work computer, and it reminds you to not always just prioritize clearing out your inbox, but if you do find yourself with 5 minutes, 30 minutes, 1 hour, fill it with something else instead. But putting a physical reminder, a visual reminder in your office can be really helpful for you to take these ideas and implement them on an everyday basis.
And that's so doable for everybody because then they define it to how what works for them in their life. So become time aware and then get these implementation reminders.
Exactly. I mean, that's one thing I'm really careful about in my research is I don't talk mm-hmm. about you should be spending X amount of time in these mm-hmm. activities and not on these. We all have different activities that bring us joy and satisfaction. Generally, in my research, active leisure activities like volunteering and socializing produce greater happiness than passive leisure activities like relaxing, napping, doing nothing. But ideally, we need both passive and active leisure, and everyone needs a different amount depending on their goals and values in life. So it's important to do some reflection, even put that in your calendar, reflect on what I want to spend more time doing, and then try to find ways each and every day to spend a little bit more time engaging in these activities that you want to do mm-hmm. versus activities you feel like you have to.
You know, Dr. Willens, I'm looking in my schedule right now, and I have a scheduled nap and do nothing for the next little bit, so we're going to have to let you go. It's not that I don't want to talk to you more, but it's in the schedule, and I have to be true to where I have allotted my time. So, Dr. Willens, a social psychologist and Harvard Business School assistant professor, you can find more information on the research that she is doing by going to awillens.com. I'll spell it awillans.com. Thank you so much for being with us.
Next up, we'll tell you about the common mistakes that could kill your garden before it even starts growing.
Or, as we may phrase it, an intervention for Lisa Valentine Clark and her garden. You're listening to The Lisa Show. Welcome back to The Lisa Show.
I've been told that it's time to start thinking about your garden because you've got to do it before you're done with the frost because you got to plan and start seeds.
Who,
this is
who
all
told
I know.
You? Is this the royal we, someone?
No,
a friend? Did a friend tell you this?
The local news. The local news guy.
was like, this is what you got to start doing. Listen, I've had a lot of interventions in my life, and I'm not a natural gardener, but I know that a lot of people have gotten into it, especially over COVID, mm-hmm. because we're at home and we're thinking about it and plotting it all out. And so knowing that this is the time across the country, no matter what the weather's like, to think about it, we want to get you ready.
The joke around these parts is that mm-hmm. Lisa Valentine Clark has two black thumbs.
That is the joke. If
a green,
so funny.
If a green thumb is what helps us to grow things, Lisa has two black thumbs. So here to help us with an intervention.
It's not an intervention.
Some sort of guiding tips, because maybe Lisa Valentine Clark, for you and others who have seen the success of others in their garden, they're thinking, you know what? I want to do this. I want to be on board. I want to have a garden. I want to enjoy the freshest vegetables that have been worked and toiled under
right.
my own sweat.
I would love to enjoy that. I want fresh produce.
We have author of the book, The First Time Gardener, Growing Vegetables. It's Jessica Sowards. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
So for first time gardeners, where do we start?
Well, I, like you, was a black thumb. I proclaimed that over myself. And so what I've learned is that the first-time gardener really has to approach the garden with a long-term view. Instead of growing a garden for 1 year, deciding to grow as a gardener over the course of years,
oh.
it really puts you in a better mindset, because you're going to have failures. You're going to mess up. That's part of the process. And if you come at it thinking, I'm going to grow as a gardener rather than I just mm-hmm. want to grow a garden, when you fail, you don't see that as the end of the story.
That's very encouraging. Okay, so if we're investing long term, then how does that change how we plan or plot out our garden?
Well, you look at it more as a classroom, and that's kind okay. of my approach. It's what I encourage people to do. So whenever you're starting your garden, you know, you're looking at, I want to grow this because I want to learn how to grow this, rather than I want to grow this because I need to get the food right now.
Yeah.
And what happens when you're deciding to learn, you still get food, and eventually you get more food and more food and more food as you learn. But it's less discouraging when you approach it that way, I think.
So what are some good plants to start growing, even if we've maybe had some bad experiences in the past?
Well, first, the first question is, what do you buy at the store? You know, if you're buying those little blister packs of cherry tomatoes and you're spending $4 or $5 each, grow cherry tomatoes. If you're buying little melons, like cut up already, grow melons. Like, grow the things you're really going to use. Like, really easy stuff for first-time gardeners are things like cherry tomatoes, baby greens, maybe radishes, some things that come to fruition a little quicker than those big, wonderful slicer heirlooms. We love those, but they might be a little bit more of a learning curve to get to fruition. Mm.
Do you recommend doing some of those easier things to sort of build the confidence as a gardener? Say, if I'm not interested in actually eating the cherry tomatoes, and I don't know what kind of person that is, but just for the sake of it, you know, that I maybe don't want to eat those, but because of the ease and the confidence mm-hmm. building in those easier, you know, vegetables or those things, would you recommend that?
Absolutely. I think understanding how plants grow and what they need, growing those things that typically will be a little bit easier, it is a major confidence booster. So even if you're giving part of your harvest away, maybe to a cherry tomato eating neighbor, it's still going to teach you how to tend soil and how to manage water and all of the different things that will lend to success on the things that you do want to eat in future gardening years.
How much time and effort should first-time gardeners really expect or set themselves up for?
Well, that's really going to depend on the size of your garden, but I would say that if you are committed to putting 10 or 15 minutes a day into it, then you're much more likely to have success than if you're coming at this hoping to maybe throw a few hours at it every weekend, because daily maintenance just makes it a lot more manageable overall, even if you have a very small garden, even if you have a larger garden.
Pro tip for parents, if you need a break from your kids, and we can say that we need that. If you say, hey, come help me in the garden.
Help me weed.
Help me in the garden. You know that you will get whatever amount of time that takes in the garden without your kids.
It.
Huh?
Okay,
a little reverse kind of stuff.
Nice.
Now you mentioned, as we talk about, you know, sort of plotting this out, and we're in the time right now. The what we're going to plant, that's part of it as well.
Yeah, we're thinking about it.
What are other components that maybe wouldn't come top to mind that we need to be thinking about at this time?
Just as far as like getting ahead of yourself, I think it's really easy to become very overwhelmed in the beginning. And so just getting started, thinking about what you're going to plant, thinking about getting your plot ready and planning out where your garden is going to be is a really great place to start. I think people overthink things, and I think that they try to solve all the problems before they're even presented. And it's really easy to become overwhelmed reading about pest control and reading about all the organic gardening methods. And you might be stressing about insects that don't even live in your region. And so I really suggest people just get started and, as a student, deal with those issues as they arise instead of throwing your hands up on the front end because it feels like too much work and might not even really be something you have to worry about.
Where is the best place for your garden?
Where you can see it. Do not put it in the back 40 of your yard, like the back fence line where you can forget about it, because you need that thing to be in your face when it gets hot outside and it's easy to put off that 10 or 15 minutes a day. Where you can easily access it with water. In the winter, it might feel like it's not going to bother you very much to haul water with buckets out to your garden, and I'm here to tell you it will. Mm-hmm. You're not going to stick with it. Your garden will die. And lastly, 6 to 8 hours of sunlight a day for the most productive vegetable garden. That's actually considered full sun, 6 to 8 hours. It doesn't have to be in sun from morning to night.
And so then what should we be doing to prep our gardens for spring right now?
It depends really on what kind of garden you have. Of course, you have raised beds and in-ground and containers, but the main thing is getting your soil prepared by adding in organic matter like compost or composted manure, things that you can buy in bags at the store, and then getting ready to mulch it. You don't have to mulch your garden right away, but as soon as it's planted, you're going to want to get some sort of covering over that soil to keep it as healthy as possible.
I've got lots of questions about like what kind of soil is the best or mulch, but I'm wondering if I'm getting ahead of myself now.
I think those are good questions to ask. I think knowing what you're going to do for a soil plan on the front end is really good. If you're filling a lot of space, let's say you're building several raised beds, you're going to need to talk to a nursery or some sort of compost manufacturer. A lot of times you can find those from local nurseries. And it might be the most frugal to just get a truckload of soil delivered to your house rather than trying to purchase it by bag. You can get soil tests at local extension offices. It's extremely easy. You literally just take a little Ziploc baggie of soil in, and they will give you, and a lot of times it's free, a lot of times it's just a few dollars. They'll give you back an analysis of your soil, tell you exactly what it needs. That's not strictly necessary. Again, you could be getting ahead of yourself. It might be, if you're really an analytical person, you might want to do it that way. Personally, my first year, I just planted things, and the stuff that didn't do well, I was like, I should probably do something about the soil.
That seems like an easier option.
Yeah. It depends on your personality there, how you're going to approach that.
Plus, and you mentioned this, as far as the cost effectiveness of getting a load delivered, you don't realize how popular of a person you can become if you get a big load of manure dropped at your house. Like, neighbors just love if you have that big pile in your driveway. It's like, hey, anyone, help yourselves. Come on.
Yeah, it depends what if your neighbors are gardeners. If you have gardener neighbors, that's true. They're going to be really excited about it.
So there is so much to consider. I mean, we've been talking now for almost 10 minutes about these tips for the first-time gardener, and I feel like we've really just scratched the surface. Jessica Sowards, you have written this book to really just help people. People want to do this.
Yeah.
Do you think that it's sort of an innate thing that we have within us as human beings, that we want to grow the food that we eat?
I do. I actually think that there's something universally satisfying about growing a garden. And you mentioned before that COVID has created a great upswing in gardeners. That is 100% true. Massive explosion in our genre just in the last year, because a lot of people saw empty shelves at the grocery store. They had a lot of time on their hands. They knew they were going to be home a lot. So many people dove into the garden last year and found so much satisfaction in it. I'm hopeful that it's going to become more and more mainstream as years go by, because I do think it's satisfying for each person to get to experience growing their own food.
Now, I want to go back to what you mentioned earlier about fertilizer and our soil. And I'm wondering, as we get prepared to plant, and maybe I'm overthinking it, but I'm wondering what tips you have for keeping our soil healthy, and what kinds of fertilizers will keep it healthy.
Yeah, that's such a great question. So one thing to simplify this, because it's not overthinking it. Soil, people say soil's alive. Soil's not actually alive, but there's a ton of life in healthy soil. So I just like to imagine this little neighborhood that lives underneath the ground, and it's full of all kinds of living things. And then that simplifies things like, there's standing water in my garden. Well, you're flooding your neighborhood. The life can't sustain in that, so you need drainage. Oh, it's very, very dry here. Well, we need to add water because there, water brings life to this neighborhood. Another thing, consider how soil exists in nature outside of human interaction. Plants die and that organic matter goes back to the soil. Fruits fall and they rot in the soil. Animals defecate and add organic matter to the soil that way. I mean, everything is constantly going back to the soil and adding life. But in a garden, what do with weeds, with leaves, with dead things? We pull it all out. And so we have to change our mindset to say, I'm going to add organic matter back in rather than just taking it out. And we do that by adding compost, composted leaves, animal manure, all of these different things. And you just want to continually add things back in, because that keeps that neighborhood healthy and full of life.
Also in this time, people should be considering, if they're going to, planting their seeds so that they can be ready to transplant into their gardens as things start to warm up. What sort of advice do you have around that?
Well, the most important thing that a new gardener needs to find out is when their last frost date is. So you mentioned earlier, all over the country, no matter where you are, it's time to start thinking about it. You really need to know when your last frost date is. And that will tell you when you need to start your seeds. Typically, it's about 6 to 8 weeks before. And it's overwhelming at first, the idea of starting seeds, but it's actually totally doable, even for a new gardener. A lot of times, right there on the seed packet is the instructions that you need to get started. But in many cases, if you're not able to start things, you can sow them directly in your garden, depending on the length of your growing season. I just encourage people to just try, because you learn so much from getting your hands on it.
What are the most common questions that you get asked by first-time gardeners?
I think the one of the things that first-time gardeners are most concerned about is the sustainability of their garden. They're wanting to know, can I save seeds? People are really freaked out by the GMO topic and different things like that. One of the things that I really like to encourage people is that GMO seeds are actually not legal to sell to the home gardener. Many people are really, really concerned about accidentally buying GMO seeds. If they buy seeds at a box store, where do I order from to not get GMO seeds? And you're not going to accidentally buy GMO seeds. When you see companies that say non-GMO, they just wrote that on there because so many people ask them about it. Like, it's not a concern. All seeds marketed to the home gardener are. So it's not something you need to worry about.
Jessica, it's worth pointing out, what is GMO or non-GMO?
A GMO is a genetically modified organism, and of course we see a lot of that on our packaging in the grocery store, non-GMO, because that is an issue a lot of people are concerned about. And so a lot of times people get confused with hybrid seeds in a home garden, but hybrid is a naturally occurring cross. It might happen because people cross the pollen together, but a GMO is actually created in a lab by gene splicing. So it's not something that's going to accidentally happen in your garden, and it's just not something that people need to worry about in the home garden.
Now, this is a weird question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. When we have our little plants, whether we have nurtured them from seeds or we've bought them kind of from a big box store as younglings, how closely do we need to be watching them?
I suggest that new gardeners that have not developed the habit of keeping up with plants set an alarm to make sure you check on them every day. You want to make sure that your soil is keeping the consistency, like the moisture of a sponge that's wet but not dripping. You don't want it sopping wet, but you also don't want to let that soil get dried out whenever your plants are small, because their root systems are really small. So they need moist soil in order to stay alive. They can dry up really fast. So as long as you lay eyes on them every day, you make sure your moisture's right, You make sure they're getting enough light, therefore they're not growing really tall, what's called leggy, whenever they're really stretching out towards the light. Those are the two major things, because if you ignore them for just like 2 or 3 days, you can lose young seedlings pretty quickly.
Now, Lisa is embarrassed to ask this question, so I'll ask it for her. What song is best to sing to our younglings in the garden?
We know the science is clear.
She's not opposed to it. She just, maybe you could help us out. What do you sing or what do you say to your younglings?
I actually do sing to my plants pretty regularly because I sing all the time. But I also just tell them good morning, and I always tell them happy birthday on the day that they sprout.
Oh, I love that. I love that you said that. I'm going to do that too. See, Richie,
I asked the question because I knew she would have an answer. Real quick, before we let you go, what are you most excited to be growing this year, Jessica?
I always look forward to my tomatoes because I actually, though I love those cherry tomatoes, I love those big heirlooms. I actually will not even eat those out of season because I feel like store-bought tomatoes taste like disappointment. They're nothing like the beauty that comes in the garden. So I am so ready for tomatoes by the time the season comes around because I haven't had them since last summer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Great advice for the first-time gardener and encouragement for those of us that have been doing it maybe for a little while. It's time to be thinking about it.
Yeah.
Jessica Sarids is the star of the Roots and Refuge Farm YouTube channel, the author of The First Time Gardener Growing Vegetables, which you can find at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, Bookshop.org, and all independent bookstores. Thanks for being with us, Jessica.
Thank you, Rich.
I'm ready. I'm inspired. I think maybe I can do it. I think maybe this year's my year.
Quote of the day from The Lisa Show, store-bought tomatoes taste like disappointment. That will be the thing that...
We will never.
Vinyl lettering. It's going up. I'm doing it.
Forget that. That's what I want to paint a sign and have you put that in your garden.
Deal.
The Lisa Show is a production of BYU Radio. You can find everything you need on the BYU Radio app. You can also listen on demand there. If you want to hop over to Sirius XM, do it. We're on channel 143. There's a lot of good stuff there.
If you want to find us via a podcast application that you have on your phone, just search out The Lisa Show wherever you get podcasts. And be sure to click on the subscribe button so you do not miss a single millisecond of The Lisa Show.
On tomorrow's show, we're excited to have author Larry Loftus. He's going to give us a sneak peek of his new book, The Princess Spy.
Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show.